16. It was almost dark by the time Claire and Dale set down their packs. Ghost Ridge looked like any of the other nearby ridges. A cool evening wind from the west stirred the tall grass around them. "Are we camping here?" asked Dale, trying to catch his breath. Even though Claire had insisted on taking the backpacking tent in her rucksack, she had set a fast pace. "No," said Claire. The wind stirred her short, dark hair. "This place is sacred to the Blackfeet." She pointed to a long, narrow lake running east below the ridge. "We can camp down there as long as we move around to the other side of the lake." "Why is this place sacred?" Even as he asked the question, Dale remembered her earlier comment of how almost every natural site was sacred to someone.
"About 600 Blackfeet died near here during the bad winter of 1883 to 84, said Claire. "The tribe buried the bodies here."
She looked around, reached into her rucksack, and took out a battery-powered backpacker's headlamp.
"I can lead the way down to the lake."
"Wait a minute. How did you know about this place?"
"My mother told me. She used to ride her horse here from Heart Butte when she was little."
"And did your mother teach you Pikuni?" asked Dale. Claire nodded. Dale realized that he could see her more by starlight now than by the fading twilight. She had not yet switched on the small headlamp.
"My mother and I used to speak the Blackfeet language when we wanted privacy," she said softly, her voice almost lost under the sighing of the high grass in the night breeze. "That was the older, traditional dialect that I used with Tina."
"Tina?"
"The lady who led us here. Her Blackfeet name is Apixtisimaki, Crystal Creek Woman. She used to run the I Am Skin Nitaki before she moved to Heart Butte."
"I Am Skin Nitaki," repeated Dale. "That sounds as if it has to do with skinwalkers and tribal medicine. Was she a shaman? A holy woman?"
"I Am Skin Nitaki translates as cut hair salon," said Claire. "It's a hairstyling place in Browning that offers skin therapy, massages, and saunas, as well as cuts."
"How'd you know that she could speak traditional Pikuni?" asked Dale.
"There were indications outside her house."
"What kind of indications?"
"Subtle ones," said Claire. She gestured toward the lake. "If we don't get hiking, we're going to be setting up the tent in absolute darkness."
"Okay," said Dale, but he hesitated. "Do you want to do anything here on the ridge first?"
"Like what?"
said Claire.
"Take a leak?"
"I was thinking of a prayer or something," said Dale. "Some sort of Blackfeet ceremony?"
He could see Claire's teeth flash in the starlight. She set the headlamp straps on her head and clicked on the light.
"I don't know any Blackfeet prayers," she said, "and I'm not big on ceremony."
She began hiking down the hill. Dale paused in the farmhouse driveway. C.J. Congdon was between him and the side door. The snow was turning into a cold rain.
"What do you want, Congdon?"
"It's Sheriff Congdon to you, Stuart," rasped the fat man.
"Fine," said Dale. "Then it's Mr. Stewart to you, Sheriff. What do you want?"
"I want you to get the fuck out of here."
Dale blinked at this.
"What?" "You heard me. You don't belong here, Mr. Stewart."
"What the hell does that mean?" said Dale, trying to be amused by this deliverance-style dialogue.
"Something bad's gonna happen if you stay here."
"Is that a threat, Sheriff?"
"I don't make threats," said Congdon in a flat, almost lifeless voice. "That's just the way it is."
"I'm not bothering anyone here," said Dale, trying to keep his voice from showing the real anger he felt at this redneck talk. "Why don't you earn your salary and find the people who let the air out of my truck tires, rather than threatening law-abiding citizens?"
He could hear how stilted his words sounded even as he spoke them. Congdon stared at him through the sleeting drizzle. The brim of his western-style hat dripped. The sheriff's eyes were thin, black slits in his fat face.
"You heard me, Mr. Stewart. Get the fuck out of here before something happens."
"I think that the next thing to happen is me calling my lawyer about this harassment," said Dale.
It was pure bluster. Except for a divorce lawyer he'd consulted once a year ago, Dale knew no lawyers. Congdon turned away, lowered himself ponderously into his sheriff's car, and drove away in the snow. What next? Thought Dale. He went into the house, took off his soaked peacoat, boots, and socks in the kitchen, stood over the heating vent for a moment, and then went into the study to get dry clothes. The computer screen was still on DOS, but there was a new line of text under his "Fuck you and the Nile barge you rode in on" line.
He's right, Dale. If you don't get out of here, you'll end up as dead as Congdon.
Dale stood staring at the two sentences. It was the first time the unknown hacker had written anything that didn't amount to abstract drivel.
Whoever was writing this shit knew who he was and where he was and that he'd just spoken to Congdon.
How? And what the hell does it mean, as dead as Congdon? Is something going to get both of us? Perhaps it was his wet feet and jeans, or perhaps it was the chill breeze sliding down the stairway from the frigid second floor. But something caused Dale to start shivering, his teeth literally chattering.
So, do you believe in ghosts? Asked Dale about half an hour after he and Claire had crawled into their sleeping bags. They had made a quick dinner of soup. Dale had spent 10 frustrating minutes trying to get the campfire lighted with old matches blowing out in the wind, before Claire removed a cigarette lighter from her pocket and lighted it with one try, and, even though they'd pitched the tent in case of rain, they'd set their bags out under the stars. Wind-driven waves lapped at the shore of the small lake 15 yards away.
My mother does, said Claire. She saw several right here at Ghost Ridge.
Dale looked up at the hill looming above them. The rustling grasses sounded like urgent whispers. But do you? He asked.
I don't believe in ghosts, Claire said softly, but I saw one once.
Dale waited, lying on his stomach in the comfortable confines of the sleeping bag and cupping his chin in his palm.
I mentioned that my stepfather has a place in Mantua, continued Claire at last. My father was an artist in Florence, but after he was killed in an auto wreck, Mother married this older man from Mantua. His family has earned uncounted millions selling salami. The Salami King, a perfect title for the husband of one of Europe's foremost divas. Anyway, I was about 10 when Mother married this guy. His family made me nervous because the Salami King had a son 6 years older than me, was always on the make, and we went to stay at his house in Mantua. We still spend several weeks every spring and autumn there. The summers and winters are miserable. Do you really want to hear this story, Professor Stewart?
Yes, said Dale.
The Mantua house is truly incredible, said Claire. The Salami King commissioned an architect back in the 70s to combine three old homes dating back to the 16th century and a courtyard into one huge home, with interior design straight out of the 23rd century. The stairway up to the library, for instance, doesn't even have railings, just a single spiraling ribbon of steel for support and raw wood steps with skinny steel cables hanging on either side. It looks like some sort of dinosaur vertebrae rising up between these ancient terracotta walls, covered with the remnants of frescoes from the 1700s. Anyway, my room is just off the library, near the service elevator, and I have windows that look both outward onto the piazza and inward down onto the ancient courtyard that the architect had enclosed with clear plexiglass doors and roofed in with steel. One night that first autumn we visited, I awoke sometime after 3 a.m. to the sound of a woman weeping. At first I was afraid it was my mother. This was less than a year after Father's death, and I knew she sometimes cried in private, but this crying was louder, coarser than anything I'd ever heard from Mother. I ran to the open interior window, since the crying was coming from inside the house. It was a woman dressed in black, just like so many of the old Italian women in Mantua and Florence today, but this was not an old woman. She wore a scarf, but I could see long, lustrous black hair escaping from it, and I could tell by her carriage and figure that she was a younger woman, in her 20s perhaps, and she was carrying a baby. A dead baby. How could you tell it was dead? Whispered Dale.
I could tell, said Claire. The baby's eyes were sunken and glazed over and staring. Its flesh was bloated and white beyond white. Its little hands were frozen into claws by rigor mortis. I could almost smell it.
Your window onto the courtyard was that close? Said Dale, trying not to sound skeptical.
It was that close, said Claire. And then the woman looked up at me. Not at me, not through me, but into me. And then she just disappeared. One instant she and the baby were there, the next instant they weren't.
You said you were 10, suggested Dale. Claire had been lying on her back, looking at the stars as she recited all this, but now she rolled over to look at him. The little backpack stove sat between them, separating their bedrolls like a modern-day sword of honor.
I was 10, but I saw what I saw, she said softly.
And of course there's a legend in the town about a woman whose baby died in that house, said Dale.
Of course, said Claire. Actually, the baby had drowned in the well that used to be in that particular courtyard. The mother, who was only 20, it turned out, refused to allow the child to be buried. She carried it around for weeks until the Mantuans restrained her and buried the child. Then the mother threw herself down the same well. That all happened late in the 1600s.
Good legend, said Dale.
I thought so.
Any chance that you heard the legend before you saw the ghost? He asked.
No, said Claire, two hearts. No chance at all. My stepfather and his family wouldn't talk about what I saw. I finally coaxed the story out of an 86-year-old cook whose family had served the household for 5 generations.
Dale had rubbed his chin, feeling the stubbled whiskers there. So you do believe in ghosts, he said.
No,
said Claire, two hearts. There was a silence, and then the two of them laughed at the same time. What do you believe, Claire? Asked Dale. She looked at him for a long moment. Then she unzipped her old sleeping bag and folded back the top, in spite of the cold air. She had slipped out of her jeans and sweatshirt before crawling into the bag, and now her bra and underpants glowed very white in the starlight.
I believe, she said, that if you come over here, Professor Stewart, our lives are going to be changed in some way that neither one of us can imagine.
Dale had hesitated, but only for the space of 10 or 15 wild heartbeats. The 5 black dogs circled the farmhouse for days. When Dale came outside, they retreated to the fields or disappeared behind the outbuildings and barn. When he went back inside, they moved in close, circling, sitting, watching. Their tracks were everywhere in the melting snow and mud. At night, he could hear them howl. Finally, he got tired of them, went out to his Land Cruiser and drove to Oak Hill. There was a hardware store there that sold firearms and ammunition. Dale bought 2 boxes of 410 long shells. Driving out of Oak Hill, he saw the tall cornices of the Carnegie Library and pulled into the tiny parking lot. He had come here a few times as a kid. The Elm Haven Library had been tiny, its books musty with age, but Dale knew that Duane had used this library regularly, sometimes walking all the way from his farm on the railroad tracks to do research here. A weight seemed to lift off Dale's shoulders as he settled into a study carrel and began to read from the heap of books he had collected in the stacks. This was more his métier, the books, the quiet hum of purposeful reading, the lamps on the tables, a clean, well-lighted space. Dale took a crumpled page of yellow legal pad paper out of his pocket. He had been carrying around the handwritten list of DOS messages for days. Now he looked at the last quote.
The lords of right and truth are Thoth and Astes, the Lord Amentet, the Cha-Cha round the Osiris are Kesta, Hapi, Tuamutef, and Kebsenuf, and they are also round about the constellation of the Thigh in the northern sky, those who do away utterly sins and offenses, and who are in the following of the goddess Hetepsekos are the god Sebek and his associates who dwell in the water.
Dale had never researched or taught Egyptian mythology, but as an undergraduate decades earlier, he had gone through an avid Howard Carter phase, so he remembered some of this context and knew the source. These words were from the Papyrus of Ani, also known as the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Amazingly, the Oak Hill Library had a copy of this book, and now Dale used the index to look up the various names. Anubis, although not mentioned directly, had to be involved and was the easiest god to track down. Also known as Anpu, Anubis was the jackal-headed son of Nephthys and Osiris and the deity given the greatest duties in guiding souls to the afterlife and protecting them once they were there. Anubis was the god of embalming and the god of the dead, although it became obvious in the Egyptian Book of the Dead that this role was usurped by Osiris as the centuries rolled past. It was thought that Anubis wore the head of a jackal, or a dog, because of the jackals and wild dogs that lurked around the Egyptian tombs, graves, and cities of the dead, always waiting for a rotting morsel. Dale followed the research trail to Plutarch. The ancient historian had written, "By Anubis they understand the horizontal circle, which divides the invisible, to which they give the name of Isis, and this circle equally touches upon the confines of both light and darkness. It may be looked upon as common to them both, and from this circumstance arose that resemblance, which they imagined between Anubis and the dog, it being observed of this animal, that he is equally watchful as well by day as night. This much, however, is certain, that in ancient times the Egyptians paid the greatest reverence and honor to the dog, though by reasons of its devouring the Apis after Cambyses had slain him and thrown him out, when no animal would taste or so much as come near him, he then lost the first rank among the sacred animals which he had hitherto possessed." Dale read on, following the maze of connections through the available books and then onto the internet, using one of the library's surprisingly new computers. In all the sources, Anubis emerged as a psychopomp, the creature charged with ushering the souls of the dying from this world to the next. It was Anubis who mummified and prepared the corpse of Osiris. It was also the jackal god who assisted Maat in judging these souls for truth and was considered the primary messenger from the underworld. Anubis was the opener of the way, presiding over the oval gateway to the realm of the dead. That gateway, known to the ancient Egyptians as the Dat, or Dwat, or Twat. Dale blinked at this, realizing that the Egyptian gateway to the dead was in the form of a vagina, that portal both to and from this life. "Twat," he said aloud, appreciating the etymological genealogy, and then realized that an elderly woman at the next computer was scowling fiercely at him. Dale smiled wanly and went back to his study carol. He realized that it would take days to track down the provenance of all the other spirits and gods mentioned in his short email message, but he stayed at the books long enough to confirm that the constellation of the thigh was now known as the Great Bear, and that the Cha-Cha, or spirits of Kesta, Hapi, Tuamutef, and Kebsenef, were chosen from the seven spirits whom Anubis had appointed as guardians and protectors of the dead body of Osiris. The goddess Hatshepsut, he discovered after 2 more hours of reading, was the Eye of Ra. He had no idea what that really meant, although it sounded like a sunbeam to him. He was getting tired. Dale returned the Egyptian books to their shelves and looked at his crumpled paper. He looked at the first line of the first message he had copied.
"Gabble, wretchets, yeth, wished hounds."
Dale checked a library clock. It was after 6 p.m. The library closed at 9. He was starving. Sighing, unwilling to give up the hunt just yet, he went back to the stacks. A moldering old book with a surrendering spine, a book that had, according to the still-used checkout stamps glued in the front, last been checked out on June 27, 1960. Exactly the kind of book Dale knew that would have long since been thrown away by any modern library, provided him with the jackpot. The book was titled English and Cornish Regional Myths and Folk Tales. The Yeth or Wisht Hounds were, as he thought, heath hounds, demonic dogs given to wandering the moors, hounds of the Baskervilles, always black dogs. It turned out that demonic black dogs
Phantom dogs, spectral dogs, had quite a history in Lancashire, West Yorkshire, Cornwall, and the Quantock Hills of Somerset. At Brook House, Snitterfield, in an ancient home formerly called the Bellbrook Inn, during World War II, guests and locals observed a big black dog haunting the grounds. The dog had red eyes, and it left no footprints in the freshly tilled garden. In 1190 AD, near the Welsh Marches, a chronicler named Walter Mapp wrote of spectral black hounds, huge and loathsome, haunting the fields. These spectral hounds invariably presaged violent death in the area. On Sunday, August 4, 1577, the parishioners of the church in Bungay, Suffolk, huddled against a memorably violent thunderstorm. In several written accounts, it was told of a terrifying black dog that suddenly appeared inside the church, slavering and howling, roaming the aisles while the faithful cried out for divine help. Three people touched the hound. Two of them died instantly, and the third shriveled up like a drawn purse. In separate accounts, but on the same August day in 1577, the same or similar hounds appeared in the church in Blythburg, several miles away, killing another three people there and blasting others. Dale skipped ahead to 1613 AD when a black dog as big as a bull suddenly appeared during services at Great Chart in Kent, killing more than a dozen people before demolishing a wall and disappearing. Dale pulled down more old books, tracking the black dog legends all the way to Beowulf, learning that Grendel was primarily lupine.
Him of Aegum stood liga, jellicost, loita un fagur.
From his eyes shone a firelike, baleful light, before watching the legend disappear into the mists of prehistory via the Frankish Lex Salica, the Lex Ripuaria, the legends of Odin's wolves in Grimismal, and the Eddic poem Helreth Brynhildar, which spoke of the Hrotgarm, the howling dog that ate corpses and breathed fire. All of the black dogs in all of these legends seem to be associated primarily with corpses, the dead, funeral grounds, funeral pyres, and the underworld. Dale was reminded that the Varg was a worrier of corpses. Dale realized that he could make a doctoral dissertation out of this crap, given the proper primary sources and a few years. It looked as if the connection between spectral black dogs and the realm of the dead ran through Indo-European mythologies into prehistory, through Vedic, Greek, and Celtic myth, offered hellhounds in such epic Scandinavian poems as Baldr's Dramar, Baldr's Dreams, left paw prints through American Indian legend, and offered death-bound devil dogs romping through Altaic shamanic ritual and pre-classical Greek thought and the Hindu Mahabharata, while all of it pointed straight back to old Anubis and his Egyptian underworld pals. It gave Dale a headache. He shelved the last of the books, realized that he was the only person in the building other than the librarian, saw with a shock that it was 3 minutes before 9 p.m., and went out into the cold night to his truck. Dale was halfway between Oak Hill and Elmhaven when his cell phone rang. The sudden noise startled him enough that he almost drove off the dark county road. He grabbed the instrument from the passenger seat where it had been lying for days. Hello? Silence on the line, but a sense of presence. In a wash of emotion that made him pull the truck to the side of the empty highway, Dale knew that it was his lover Claire on the line. Claire calling him after more than a year, Claire telling him that his life and reality could resume once again.
Daddy?
For an instant, Dale felt only vertigo. The voice, the two syllables, all lacked context.
Daddy, are you there?
It was his older daughter, Margaret Beth. Mab, away at Claremont College in California.
Mab, what is it, baby? What's wrong?
An exhalation through the receiver.
We've been going crazy trying to get in touch with you, Daddy. Where have you been?
Dale shook his head in confusion. A pickup truck drove past him in the night, an old man's face checking the Land Cruiser to see if Dale needed help.
I've been right here in Illinois, kiddo, right where I told everybody I'd be. Is everything all right?
Everything's all right here, Daddy, but you don't have a phone number there and you never answer your cell phone number. Katie and I have been trying to call you or write you. Did you get the letters we sent?
Dale blinked. He had told his daughters, as well as his colleagues and business associates, that he would pick up his mail care of General Delivery in Elmhaven. He had never thought to do so. "Sorry, kiddo," said Dale. "I've been busy." He heard how silly that phrase sounded. "What's up, Mab? Are you calling from Clermont?"
"No, Daddy, I'm home for Christmas vacation. We needed to know if you were coming back this way."
Dale heard the unheard word, home.
"Christmas vacation?" he said, confused again. "It's weeks until your Christmas vacation, Mab. Why are you home early?"
There was a silence broken only by the idling of the Land Cruiser and the hiss of static and distance over the frozen fields. Then Mab said,
"Dad, it's not early. Today's December 22nd.
Dale laughed. "No, it's not, kiddo. Thanksgiving was just a few days ago." He paused, not wanting to tell his daughter that he had spent the holiday with a woman they had never heard about. "Seriously, why are you home early?"
"Daddy!"
Real frustration audible now.
"It is December 22nd. Tomorrow is the day before Christmas Eve. Now stop it. You're scaring me."
"Sorry, kiddo." It was all that Dale could think of to say. He looked at his watch, switching on the overhead light in the truck to check the date. The watch had stopped at 4:15. The date said the 8th, although he had no idea what month. Another voice spoke, his younger daughter Katie, her voice still cooler but deeper than Mab's.
"Dad."
Katie had never called him Daddy. "Hey, Butch," said Dad, using his old joke name for her. He tried to keep his voice light. "How's everything?"
"Where are you?"
asked Katie. Dale looked around at the dark fields, but he could see only his own reflection in the windows and windshield.
"I'm here where I said I'd be.
I'm sorry I haven't called or checked the mail. I just got busy. I'm writing a novel, an important novel. I sort of lost track of everything, I guess."
The cell phone's low battery indicator blinked once. Dale cursed softly to himself. He did not want to lose the call now.
"Daddy," said Mab, "are you coming home for Christmas?"
Dale felt as if someone had cut through his ribs and squeezed his heart once, very tightly. He took a breath. "I hadn't thought about it, kiddo. The ranch," he stopped. The girls didn't want to hear about the ranch or its renters. He tried again.
Your mother,
he began and stopped.
"Mom didn't know if you'd be back in Missoula for Christmas," said Katie. It seemed to be a question.
"I don't think that she'd think that it was a good idea," Dale said at last. The low battery indicator glowed steadily.
"Daddy," said Mab at last, "Mom's just run out to the drugstore for something, but she should be home in a minute or two. If she called your cell phone number in just a couple of minutes, would you talk to her about you coming home while we're all here for Christmas?"
Dale could not speak. His mind seemed as wind-blown and empty as the fields beyond the reflections on the glass.
"Good,"
said Mab, as if he had agreed.
"Stay where you are. Mom will call back in the next 2 minutes."
The line went dead. Dale clicked off the phone, left its power on, and set it on the console between the two front seats. It was beginning to snow, flakes visible in the twin cones of the headlights. No other vehicles had passed him. Dale sat there for 10 minutes. His watch was still stopped, but the green letters of the dashboard clock read 9:52. He stared at his cell phone. The low battery glowed, but the power was still on. The phone rang. Dale jumped as if a rattlesnake had made a noise inches from his hand. He grabbed the phone. "Hello?" His heart was pounding, and he heard the shakiness in his voice.
"Dale. Dale, it's Michelle."
"Who?" Dale said stupidly.
"Michelle. Michelle Staffney. Dale, I've got a problem."
Her voice was also trembling. For a minute, Dale could not shift mental gears. It was as if Michelle Staffney had been only a dream and now he was beginning to doze again. She had never called him on his cell phone before. He could not remember giving her his cell phone number.
"Michelle," he said thickly, "I'm at the school grounds, Dale, in Elmhaven, on the playground where old Central School used to be."
Dale waited, wondering if he should hang up. The low battery indicator was very bright.
"And the dogs are here, Dale. They're all around me."
What?
Said Dale. The black dogs, the ones from Duane's farm, they're here, in town. They're all around me.
The phone went dead.
17. At this point, I began to worry about Dale. The missed phone call from his wife, Anne, if indeed Anne had called back at all, seems the kind of turning point that too often converts light farce to tragedy. Obviously, I know nothing about women. I grew up with just the old man and Uncle Art around and paid almost zero attention to the girls at Old Central School. I remember Michelle Staffney as the 5th and 6th grade red-headed sex grenade, but since sex didn't really mean much to kids back in that prehistoric era circa 1960, none of the boys in the bike patrol really paid much attention to her, other than to act like idiots whenever she was around. Through Dale, I have memories of sexual intercourse with girls he knew in high school and college, with Anne, even with the self-appointed Beatrice of his idolatry, this aptly named Claire Two Hearts. But memory of lust, much like memory of pain, is a surprisingly unspecific, clouded thing, and I can't say I feel that I missed too much of that particular aspect of not having lived to adulthood. I confess that I regret more never having seen King Lear perform than never having had a sexual encounter, but I don't think that Dale rushed into Elmhaven this December night on some lustful errand. He had found some respite from solitude in talking with Micah Stouffer, named Michelle Staffney, but at this point he certainly did not desire her other than in the most passing way. His affair, his romantic interlude with the person called Claire, had driven him quite far from desire's dark shores. Of course, so had the clinical depression that had rendered him impotent for months, and the heavy dosage of Prozac and other drugs that followed. One might say that Dale Stewart's libido had taken a direct hit from a pharmaceutical heat-seeking missile. If I had lived and become a writer, I might have tried to explain the role that Eros plays in the lives and misfortunes of men, but I suspect that it would have been in a classical and twice-removed fashion. When I lived outside of Elmhaven, reading away my less than dozen winters and summers and equinox months, my ideal of the perfect woman was the wife of Bath. I suspect that if I had grown up, moved on, sought and found such a woman, identifiable, I always assumed, by that delightful, sensuous gap between her front teeth, I would have, in the end, fled from the vitalism of such a sexual life force. More to the point, what would she have wanted with me, the sedentary lump, the solipsistic, overweight, clumsy, and poorly dressed geek? But then again, Arthur Miller ended up with Marilyn Monroe, however briefly. Of more interest to me now than Dale's imperfect memories of past lovemaking were the images and recollections of his two daughters. Perhaps it is only with one's mother and girl children that a male human being can really hold any hope of knowing and understanding women. Margaret Beth Mab, his oldest girl, was always the apple of his eye. Remembering her through his remembering, I cannot help but think of literary equivalents I had encountered. Aaron Burr with his beloved daughter, Sir Thomas More with his. These intellectual equals were the real women in these famous men's lives, and there was some of that with Mab and Dale, at least until this Claire appeared on the scene. Catherine Sarah, Katie, rises less frequently in Dale's thoughts, but I see a wonderful person there, at least equal in her compassionate way to Mab's fierce intelligence. Katie was a feminine definition of empathy and connection, a gestalt humanist, the likes of which I never encountered in Elmhaven, either in the girl children there or in their mothers. Where Mab delighted her father with precocity in language and precision in logic, Katie was quiet as a child, observing, feeling, preparing to give of herself. Dale did not ignore this trait in his youngest daughter. He loved both of his children and admired Katie's empathy beyond words, but where Mab's strengths might reflect, and thus confirm, his own, Katie's human beauties were most like her mother's. It might be this sharp fact that made him think more of Mab in his exile than, more painfully, of Katie. I won't speculate further here. I understood very little of being a son and nothing at all about being a father of girls. Before we return to Dale's chivalric rush to save Ms. Staffney from the black dogs, we should discuss the book he is writing, the Elmhaven in Summer book, and the issue of his writing in general. Dale
was not a good writer, trust me on this. I was a better writer at age 9 than my friend is in his 52nd year. The reason is, at least partially, I suspect, that he was not born to the craft, not driven to the task by the non-negotiable flames of internal fires, but, rather, made a conscious decision to become a writer at the end of that summer of 1960, the summer in which I died. Adding to that is the simple fact that in training to be an academic, Dale was crippled by the need to write in academese. It is not a language formed by any human tongue, and few, if any, academics survived the degradation of it to move on to actual prose. Finally, there is the choice of Dale's fiction, Mountain Man stories. This was a conscious choice on his part, an attempt to retain his professional status by not slumming in such genres as mystery or science fiction or, God forbid, horror. But again, a cool one, a cerebral one, and not one forged by desire, patterning his style on the work of the limited genre's masters, Vardis Fisher, for one. Dale wrote about the few white men in the West of the 1830s and the Native American tribes. His professor self made it almost impossible to be politically incorrect enough to think Indians, even though his mountain man characters did so frequently enough, much less frame some obscenity like savages. Hemingway once wrote that a true writer had to work from the inside out, not from the outside in. The difference, he explained, between art and photography, between Cézanne and mere documentation. All of Dale Stewart's so-called Jim Bridger books, as I have said before, were written from the outside in. Claire had confronted him with this fact more than once, and Dale had demurred rather than defend himself, but he was hurt. He thought of his books as a contribution to literature, sort of. She would not allow him that illusion, just as, in the end, she allowed him none of the illusions one needs for survival. This Elmhaven book that Dale is so enthused about, the book that makes him willing to stay at the Jolly Corner despite its discomforts and psychic uneasiness, is, at least, different from the Mountain Man books, but it is also, in its own exuberant way, a lie. It is all sunlight and summer days, swimming holes and dirt clod fights, bicycle freedoms and idealized friendships. Dale had sworn, in his own mental preparation to write this book, to be true to the secrets and silences of childhood, but in his actual writing of it, the secrets have become smug and the silences far too loud. Dale Stewart's work lacked irony without even the protective camouflage of the postmodernist abandonment of irony. Dale the man might have been ironic at times, this time seeking protective camouflage, about the whole idea of writing mountain man tales, but the tales themselves were almost never leavened by irony or self-judgment. A work completely devoid of irony has no more hope of becoming literature than does the most sincere piece of Christian apologetics or Marxist polemic. As Oscar Wilde once said, all bad poetry is sincere. Dale's writing in both the Mountain Man Entertainments and his Elmhaven Summer of 1960 manuscript was overwhelmingly sincere. Of course, this is just my opinion, and I hope that I would not have become a literary critic, or its idiot sibling, a reviewer of books, had I lived. Certainly my pedantic and opinionated side would have gravitated to that vocation, but all good things beyond sleep come precisely because we defy gravity while we live. Besides, somewhere in the basement of the Jolly Corner, to this day, mildewing amidst the pages of an equally mildewed paperback, is a 3x5 card on which I had scribbled this quote from Flaubert. Books aren't made the way babies are. They are made like pyramids. There's some long-pondered plan, and then great blocks of stone are placed one on top of the other, and it's back-breaking, sweaty, time-consuming work, and all to no purpose. It just stands there on the desert, but it towers over it prodigiously. Jackals piss at the base of it, and the bourgeois clamber to the top of it, etc., continue this comparison. I was 8 when I jotted down that quote, but even then, the part I enjoyed most was the delightful continue this comparison, and even then, I understood at once that the pissing jackals were critics. It was only a little after 10 p.m. when Dale drove into Elmhaven, but from the darkened and abandoned feel of the little town, it might as well have been 3 a.m. on Walpurgisnacht. The fastest way from Oak Hill to Elmhaven was the old way, Oak Hill Road, which ran north and south, crossing 150A just east of the Elm Haven city limits. Dale drove quickly down Main, noting but ignoring the dark storefronts, the empty lots, and the lack of streetlights, then turned north up 2nd Avenue to the schoolyard. He saw Michelle Staffney and the dogs almost at once. The schoolyard, once the near-majestic tableaus of the huge old central school on its low hill, surrounded by ancient playgrounds and sentinel elms, was now just this flat and treeless patch of weeds poking through dirty snow, the field littered with some sad plastic playground equipment, an empty parking lot, and some town storage sheds. Michelle was at the top of the slide. The five dogs, the lead dog looking impossibly large in the headlights, as if it could easily leap to the top of the slide without exertion, stood around the slide like points on a five-sided star. Dale stopped the car sideways in the asphalt street, headlights cutting white cones from the old schoolyard's darkness, and hesitated. The dogs did not turn toward the light or acknowledge the Land Cruiser's presence. Michelle Staffney's face was white and her eyes wide as she raised one hand more in appeal than greeting. Dale drove off the pavement, across the low ditch that had been much deeper when he had crossed it every day on his walk across Depot Street to the school, and accelerated across the snowy field toward the slide. The five black dogs did not move. Their gaze stayed locked on the middle-aged woman at the top of the ladder. Dale felt panic and tasted bile. For an instant, he was sure that the five dogs were going to attack Michelle before he closed the last 10 yards. Then drag her down and off into the deeper snow and higher weeds behind the steel storage shed. The dogs did not move. In a surge of absolute, senseless hatred, Dale gunned the throttle and slewed to run down the largest dog, the one he thought of as the original black dog, even though it was four times too large to have been so. The dog whirled and ran an instant before Dale had to decide whether to break wildly or actually run down a defenseless animal. Probably someone's pet. The other four dogs also turned and loped into the darkness, each of them running in a different direction and all five blending into the night in seconds. Dale slid the Land Cruiser to a stop, throwing up snow and dirt as he did so. Leaving the headlights on, he stepped onto the running board. "Michelle, you all right?" The white face nodded. She was wearing a light parka and a scarf and mittens. In the harsh glare of the halogen headlights, Michelle looked simultaneously much older than she had the last time he had seen her, and somehow much younger, childlike. Dale thought that perhaps it was the mittens. He walked over to the slide and held his hand up as she descended. She ignored the hand, but touched his arm when she reached solid ground. "What happened?" said Dale. Michelle shook her head again. "I don't know. I was out for a walk." "This late?" said Dale, and realized how silly that sounded. At 10 p.m. in Beverly Hills, she would probably still be at dinner before the late screening of a new film. "They just appeared," said Michelle, and began shaking. Dale reached a hand out to reassure her, just as an extra pair of headlights swept across the schoolyard and pinned them. A car was driving across the snow toward them. The car stopped next to Dale's truck, but the headlights blinded them. The silhouette of a heavy-set man emerged from the driver's side.
"Trouble here?" came C.J. Congdon's phlegmy voice.
Michelle suddenly leaned against Dale. She was shaking very hard now. She turned away from the sheriff's headlights, almost burying her face in Dale's coat.
"No trouble," said Dale. "You drove up on city land here, Mr. Stewart," said Congdon.
Dale could see the headlight glare reflecting off the underside of the sheriff's smoky hat, but the big man's face was still in shadow.
"City property. You've been drinking, Professor?"
Dale waited for Michelle to say something, but she kept her face against his chest.
"Ms. Stouffer here was taking a walk," called Dale, his voice sounding very loud to himself in the cold night. "Some huge dogs appeared and started to attack her. I saw her and drove out here so the truck's lights would drive them away."
He was irritated at himself for providing such a detailed explanation to this fat slob of an ex-bully.
"Dogs," said Congdon, his tone dismissive and amused. To Michelle, he said, "You better come with me, missy. I'll drive you home.
Michelle gripped Dale tightly now, her arms hugging him fiercely through her parka and his jacket.
No,
she whispered to Dale. I'm taking her home, said Dale. He put his arm around her and led her to the passenger side of the Land Cruiser. The sheriff's car was at enough of an angle that the vehicle and its driver remained just dark silhouettes against the night. The cheap plastic slide and swingless swing set looked unreal. Too bright. Too orange and red. Too fake. In the twin sets of headlights.
She should ride with me, said C.J. Congdon from the other side of the police cruiser. His voice was flat,
emotionless, but somehow both amused and threatening. Dale ignored the sheriff, helped Michelle up into the truck, shut the door carefully, and went around to the driver's side. For an instant he wondered what he would do if Congdon came around his own car and tried to stop Dale from driving off. Why would he do that?
Because you questioned his authority, stupid, was Dale's answer to himself. Congdon did not come around.
Dale backed the Land Cruiser up, turned it around on the snowy field, and drove back to the asphalt line of Second Avenue. Checking in his rearview mirror, Dale could see only the headlights of the sheriff's car. Congdon did not follow. Dale drove up to the junction of Depot Street, where his old house, dark now, was illuminated in the headlight beams, started to turn left, but paused.
Do you want to go home or come out to the farm? He asked.
Michelle was still shaking violently. She hadn't seemed so frightened of the dogs out at the Jolly Corner. Dale wondered if it was from the cold.
Home, she said softly.
Dale dutifully turned left on Depot Street and drove toward Broad and the old Staffney house there.
I mean home in California, said Michelle.
Dale laughed. He turned to look at her, to smile reassuringly, but he could see only the pale white oval of her face in the darkness. He had an irrelevant memory of the faceless man in uniform he'd glimpsed twice on his walks past the cemetery. The Staffney house was absolutely dark. Her own truck was not in the driveway, nor were there tire tracks.
It's in the shop in Oak Hill, said Michelle,
her voice more steady now.
It's some black box screwing up the ignition system. They say it'll be a few days before they get the part in.
You all right for groceries and everything? Said Dale. Michelle nodded and touched his arm again.
Thanks for saving me.
He tried to sound light as he said, I don't think the dogs meant to hurt you. The white oval of her face bobbed up and down. Although he could not tell if she was agreeing or signifying that the dogs had meant her harm.
I'd never get in a car with him, she said softly,
and it took Dale a few seconds to realize that she was speaking of Sheriff C.J. Congdon.
I don't blame you, he said. Shall I come in with you until you get the lights on?
No need, said Michelle.
She handed him a square box, and it took him a minute to realize that it was the box of 410 shells he'd bought in Oak Hill earlier that evening.
This was on the passenger seat, and I didn't want to sit on it, she said.
Dale set the box of shells in the back seat.
I could have thrown them at the dogs, he thought.
The overhead lights came on as she opened the passenger door, but her face was turned away so Dale could not see her expression, see if she had thought his invitation to see her inside had been a come-on. Walking around the truck to stand outside his open driver's side window, the snow crunching under her feet, she said,
Just watch until I get down the drive, would you? Make sure the hounds don't get me.
Her voice sounded normal.
The power's off right now, so I'm using candles and flashlights until it's fixed. Don't worry if you don't see any lights.
If the power's off, do you have heat? No need to stay here in a cold, dark house. Dale tried to think of where he'd sleep. Duane's bed in the basement, giving her the day bed in the study, or upstairs while she took the more comfortable bed.
The furnace works, said Michelle.
He could see starlight reflected in her eyes now.
It's on a separate circuit. Diane and I blew some fuses when we were messing around with the old wiring. I've got a guy coming from Peoria to fix it tomorrow. Good night, Dale. Thanks again for rescuing me.
She reached out and squeezed his bare hand with her mittened one.
Any time, said Dale.
He watched as she walked carefully down the snowy lane and disappeared around the back of the house. As advertised, the house stayed dark, but he thought he detected the slight glow of a flashlight through a dark side window. He backed the Land Cruiser out and headed back down Depot Street toward First Avenue and the road to the Jolly Corner. There was no sign of Congdon or his car. The interior of Duane's farmhouse, except for the cold draft sliding down from the second floor, seemed warm after the cold night air. Dale went from room to room, turning on lights as he went. He carried the shotgun shells down into the basement and retrieved the two parts of his Savage Over and Under from where he'd stored them. It was time, he thought, to have a real, loaded weapon on the premises. Dale was attaching the Over and Under barrel when he saw that there was a shell in the shotgun breech. He removed the red shell carefully, shocked that he would ever store a loaded weapon, even one that was broken down this way. He'd learned better than that at his father's knee when he was 6 years old. The shell had an indentation, the mark of a fallen firing pin near the center of its brass circle. This was the shell, the one that had misfired a year ago, November, when he had tried to take his own life. Dale stepped backward and sat on the edge of Duane's old brass bed. The springs creaked. He took out his treasured Dunhill lighter, flicked it on, and turned the shell around and around in his hand, looking at the gleam of light from the lighter flame glint on the brass. There was no doubt this was the suicide attempt shell. I threw it away, here at the farm, before I stored the weapon, threw the shell far out into the field. Had he? Dale had a distinct memory of walking out across the frozen mud, past the burned-out pole light, to the opening in the fence where the rows of frozen corn began, and tossing a shell far out into the night. Maybe it was a different shell. That made no sense. He had found only the one shotgun shell when he had discovered that he had somehow packed the shotgun with his books and plates and other possessions. And I'd never have stored the shotgun with a shell in place. Dale shook his head. He was very tired. The heavy reading at the Oak Hill Library and the strange scene with Michelle and the dogs had filled his head with blurred images. He propped the assembled Over and Under against the wall, making sure that it was open and unloaded, and went upstairs to lock the kitchen door and shut off the lights there. The ThinkPad had been turned off when he left. Now words glowed on the black screen after the C prompt. Which way I fly is hell. Myself am hell. And in the lowest deep, a lower deep still threatening to devour me opens wide, to which the hell I suffer seems a heaven. Dale stood a long minute staring at the stanza and scratching his chin. It was Milton, definitely Milton, but not from Paradise Lost. Perhaps from one of the surviving drafts for Milton's Adam Unparadised. Unlike in Paradise Lost, where Satan is the most human and compelling character, but the reader never sees Satan in his unfallen state as the beautiful Lucifer, the morning star of heaven, most favored and beloved of all of God's angels, this was hell-bent Lucifer's lament. It was derivative, Dale guessed, of Marlowe's Mephistopheles. Why this is hell, nor am I out of it. Dale was too tired to play literary trivia games. He typed, "Tell me who you are, or I'll shut this fucking computer down forever." Then he shut off the light and went downstairs to sleep in Duane's bed.